Our guest today is the well-known UFO investigator and photo analyst, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. Hello, Dr. Maccabee. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Do you think that the general public and the government are taking UFO sightings more seriously?
Well, I don't know about the government. Parts of the government may have treated it very seriously all along, but they're just not telling us. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as far as the public is concerned, if the amount of material this UFO-related could be any indication, you know, you have things like the UFO Hunters show that was on the History Channel, and I don't know if it's back again or not, but the Discovery Channel and others that do these documentary-type things have featured UFO programs practically every week for the last couple of years. That's something that would have been unheard of, you know, like 10 years ago. So I think there could well be more of an acceptance of the situation. I think if you polls that have been taken recently indicate a large fraction of the population thinks it's all real. So I guess, I don't know about the government, but it would appear that the general public is treating it more seriously.
Some people are saying that there are not any more UFOs in the skies now than there were in the past, but there are more people with cameras. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly true that there are more people with cameras. I don't know about how many UFOs there are in the sky, but there are lots of things in the sky that aren't UFOs that people pick up with their cameras. And they cause a lot of extra work, you might say, for photo analyst types like myself, getting a couple of photos a week, I should say, maybe from people with camera phones and so on. And the photos from these camera phones, which are the most ubiquitous, the most likely to find them around. You have to spend time analyzing some image that isn't well resolved. You can't really tell what it is. You can't tell how big it is, how far away it was. Very often people will take pictures of things that they'll be taking a picture of something in the scenery, a building, a hill, a mountain, trees, just general scenery, whatever, and then up in the sky area of the picture there'll be some sort of a line or a black spot or something. And I'm asked to say, well, what could this be? Could it be an insect or a bird or a film flaw, or is this an extraterrestrial craft? And generally, the image is sufficiently indistinct that you couldn't really say what it is. Very often, the image will be blurred all the way around, but more blurred on the left and the right, for example, than it is blurred on the top and the bottom, in which case you could say it was slightly out of focus and traveling from left to right or right to left, the speed of it causing some blurring, and you might conclude that it could be an insect close to the camera. So there's a lot more cameras out there, and they're generating a lot more spurious images. I don't know that they're generating a lot more true UFO photos.
How many megapixels do you think that it would take before a picture from a phone would be good enough to be analyzed?
Well, that's a tough problem, a tough question, because even if you have like a 10 megapixel camera or one of the professional types, 10 or more megapixels, you can get images that are questionable as to what they might be. It's just that with these, anything that's got, say, less than 4 or 5 megapixels, it's going to have to be a really big image to get a good estimate of the shape of the image. When you take a picture with too few megapixels, you get a fuzzy edge of almost everything. Camera phone pictures are notorious for being a few hundred, half a million or something like that. I don't know. They're like the digital cameras were 10 years ago.
Yeah, they're just starting to get to be up to 5 megapixels, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, it's always worth paying some attention to that. You never know when somebody might come up with something. But you got to have an image that's big enough to be 20 or 30 or 40 or something like that, maybe 100 pixels of the image before you can begin to say much about it. Somebody comes up with an image, and I've had people say, tell me what this is, and this image is maybe 10 pixels in size. Well, you take anything that you can think of, break it into 10 individual little pieces, a picture, break it into 10 pieces, little 10 little square blocks, and then ask yourself, how well imaged is that? It's not very good, that's what it amounts to.
Right. What were your thoughts when you had been told over and over that UFOs didn't exist, and then you received Freedom of Information documents that showed that the FBI and military knew that UFOs were extraterrestrial?
Well, as far as the FBI documents are concerned, the only reference to FBI documents in early literature, and I'm talking about back in the 50s, was Captain Edward Ruppelt's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, in which he says that the FBI was never interested in the subject, which shows what he knew, basically nothing. When I got the first stack of FBI documents in the spring of 1977, and was reading through them and arranging them in some sort of a order instead of just a random hodgepodge of pages, I was reading that the FBI actually did investigate in 1947, investigated a number of witnesses. Ostensibly, they investigated to find out if there were any possibility of communist subversion. They were asked by the Air Force to investigate to see if communist subversion could explain any of these sightings. I guess the idea was that the Soviets might generate spurious sightings of highly technological craft to give the impression to the American people that the Soviets had jumped ahead of us. The FBI couldn't find any evidence of Soviet subversion going on in terms of the witnesses that they talked to, and so they got out of it. But the FBI headquarters was like a black hole. Once they had established a connection with the Air Force kept sending them stuff, and they stored it. Congress had directed that the headquarters of FBI could not destroy anything. So when I filed the Freedom of Information Act request in the fall of 1976, and then many months later got a phone call from a very surprised FBI agent saying he found 1,600 pages of stuff in the FBI files, that really surprised me too. I knew that there was something going on that we didn't know before. And so it turns out the FBI collected some stuff from the Air Force that you can't even find in the Air Force files, the files of Project Blue Book. And you refer to the government knowing that they're real. We have an FBI document saying that in 1949, it was 48 or 49, that the Air Force and the Army treated the subject of UFO unidentified flying objects as top secret. Of course, they were worried about things that were seen around areas of research and related to atomic bombs, things appearing in the sky, so-called green fireballs and other types of things that they saw in the sky around these highly restricted areas. And they knew they were seeing stuff there. There's no doubt about it. It's just that the official statements always were, well, yeah, there was something there, but it wasn't a threat to the United States. And no evidence of any technology that we're not familiar with. They basically tried to poo-poo the whole thing. In my book, The UFO-FBI Connection, I tried to point out that the Air Force took practically a schizophrenic attitude towards it. On the one hand, the Air Force officer guys weren't stupid. They could see by reading reports and so on that there was something going on. But on the other hand, when it came to being publicizing what they found out, basically they said, there's nothing to it. We're handling this problem. and it established a tradition that the Air Force was doing a good job because the Air Force said, we're doing a good job, in words more or less to that effect.
Wasn't there a memo from Hoover where he complained that all the crashed UFOs were being picked up by the military and he couldn't get to see them?
Well, there was a memo in July of 1947 when the Air Force asked the FBI to investigate. This request for investigation came from a general in the intelligence part of the Pentagon, the Air Force intelligence. Hoover said, I would do it, but I must insist upon complete access to all disks recovered. For example, in the L.A. case, the Army grabbed it before we had a chance to look at it. Now, that was L, capital L, small a, which in Louisiana, there had been a case of somebody reporting a disc-shaped object that had landed in his backyard or something like that. Turned out to be a model hoax object that somebody had thrown into the backyard of somebody else. but the problem the FBI had was that they would have said, if flying saucers are created by the Soviet Union, we should be able to analyze them and prove it by identifying things made somewhere in the Soviet Union as being parts of these flying saucers. So Hoover had a legitimate requirement to be able to get copy hardware to examine, basically. The Air Force response to Hoover basically was, okay, we will give you information. But the Air Force never did give the FBI any hardware. You have, as a sort of a side story here, the Roswell case. And if you assume the Roswell case actually involved hardware, then it's clear that there was information, there was hardware materials that would prove the case, which were withheld from the FBI and everybody else. The FBI was forced to rely totally on witness interviews. We never did get any hardware from the Air Force to look at.
Do you think there could be any connection with ancient structures that seem to defy modern construction principles and UFOs or aliens?
Well, you asked, could there be? I suppose there could be. I don't know that there's any direct evidence. The people who make these arguments tend to take an opposite view argument, that being human beings could not have done it, therefore it must have been done by somebody else. And that, of course, has been argued up and down for years. Conventional archaeologists say human beings could do it given time and money and all that sort of stuff. I don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time studying those arguments. Things like, for example, of blocks, huge stone blocks weighing 10 tons or whatever of a great pyramid that are stuck together so closely you can't put a blade in between them. Comments like that. Does that mean it has to have been made by extraterrestrials with advanced technology? If they had advanced technology, would they build things out of stone blocks? Why wouldn't they build something more sophisticated? Of course, stone blocks are pretty effective if you're looking for longevity. The pyramids are still there, except for they've been torn down by human beings.
Right.
So anyway, I would say I can't rule the possibility out, but I can't definitely say it's true.
What do you think of Dr. Lear's work, where he claims to have removed over 15 alien implants from people so far?
Yeah, I haven't kept up with what the most recent on that, but it's my understanding, and I don't know if he's released all the information that he has. I haven't looked at his website or anything recently. I guess he's got a website.
Oh, he does, yes.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it recently, so I don't know, but
I've talked with him a few times, so.
You have talked to him?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I don't know how many tests of these materials he's gotten out of people, but I know for my own experience of watching when I was at the big Roswell party, not last summer, but in the summer of 2008. A man arrived who was claimed he had an implant in the webbing on his finger, one of his fingers. And we had a big, strong magnet, and we could put the magnet next to his finger, and we could actually see the skin bulge out. And if you moved the magnet back and forth, you could see it was like there was something under there trying to get to the magnet, and it was pulling on the skin. He clearly had something under there that was magnetic. And there didn't seem to be any scar that you could see. How that would have happened, I don't know. I guess I'm not familiar with the details of all the stuff that Lear has taken out, but it's certainly a way to do a reasonable type of research to try to get some of these things out of people and see what they are. And you have to imagine they could be, although they may seem like little chunks of stone or chunks of glass or whatever, they could be very sophisticated devices made to look like something simple.
Well, he's found out so far that, number one, they put out a radio signal, and number two, they connect tiny nerves in the body and use them to power the radio signal.
Yeah, I remember the little hooks or something like that that hook onto nerves.
Yeah.
And it could be, like I said, you're looking at something. If you imagine taking apart your cell phone, stripping it apart down to the point where you're looking at a little block of silicon, how the heck would you know what that's supposed to do?
That's
answer,
right.
You wouldn't.
Yeah.
You might be able to see that it's got some structure to it, some periodic array of things, and say, well, this doesn't look like it's natural. But that would be all you could do. You need two things. You need the hardware and you need the software. In the computer analogy, and the two things go together. The hardware, the software is sort of adapted to make the hardware work. And like with a computer, you turn it off, the software isn't working all of a sudden. And you look at the hardware itself, it may be hard evidence that there's a computer, but you can't tell what the hell it's doing or what it was supposed to do. Somehow you got to get the software back to make it work. So if you take one of these things out of somebody, who's to say that it's going to work the way it should? It might be a cell, almost like a self-destructing mechanism.
Well, that's why what he does is he keeps it in the blood of the person. He takes blood and keeps it in there to keep it going, because he found that if it wasn't covered in the blood, it would stop functioning.
Uh-huh. Well, like I said, I haven't really kept up on that, so.
Well, the most amazing part of his work is that these things are not rejected by the body. Some sort
mm-hmm.
of membrane formed over them.
Yep, all right.
UFOs seem to come in all different shapes. Do you think that the different shapes of UFOs indicate that different races are coming from different planets to us here?
Well, that certainly is a possibility. It could be all that one particular race has several different types of UFOs for different reasons, just like we have vehicles of different shapes. An automobile doesn't look like an airplane, but it's the same race of people who made automobiles and airplanes. So I don't know. I don't deny that there might be multiple races coming. To say that different shapes, shaped craft, is evidence of that, I think there's a disconnect there.
So many different presidents have been interested in UFOs, and yet, when they got into office, they were not able to find out as much as they thought. What do you think that this is? Are they being blocked by the military or some organization within the government?
Well, I would say it probably is blockage by some organization within the government, or at the edges of the government, some sort of a contractor type of organization. We know that Carter, in particular, before he was elected, said, oh, yeah, I'm going to release all the information. We know from the FBI file that in fact he did request NASA and other organizations, including the FBI, ask them if they had any stuff, anything that would apply to his request for releasing UFO information, and the FBI said, we don't have anything. They lied to Carter the same way they lied to everybody else, saying the FBI had never been interested in the subject, which was not true. They had been interested in it back in the 40s and 50s. But anyway, Carter, once he got in, we don't really know exactly what he did, but we do know that essentially he put out the word that he wanted information, and the FBI said, we haven't got any. That's in the FBI file itself. It was Jody Powell, I believe it was, who wrote the letter to the FBI asking for UFO information. It's a matter of record that Carter never released anything. The government would say, well, that's because we didn't have anything. And as far as the people who were associated with Carter is concerned, that might be true. They didn't know anything, and nobody told them anything. But, you know, the government is a huge organization that spends, well, I hate to think of what they spend, $20 to $30 billion on intelligence alone. And that can cover up an awful lot of stuff. You can have projects going that nobody would know about, except project managers or certain individuals who are designated as project leaders, you know. Well, the Manhattan Project and the World War II model shows how that can be done. Skeptics have argued that, well, everything's going to get leaked out at some time or other. That's not true. It depends on the nature of the material and who is being trusted to say nothing about it. The case of the Roswell crash itself is an interesting study that would indicate there was something going on inside the government, and the government tried to cover it up. But given time, certain leakers, people who decided that the outside world should know about it, came forth, and so we have now a lot of testimony by a lot of people on the Roswell case. What we still don't have, of course, is an arrow that points towards where that stuff is, who's controlling it, and so on.
In your opinion, what organization is doing the most to try and get the government to release its UFO data? And do you think that Washington ever will?
Well, I don't know what organization. There has been recent, sort of like run the flag up to see who salutes type of operation. I think by the Navy, indicating that there may be some Navy brass that would like to get this out. But aside from that, I don't know of any government organization that's trying to get this stuff out. There may be one that I just don't know about.
I know that you are sent a lot of photos to be analyzed. Have you ever gotten one that would lead you to believe that we have an advanced space plane?
Well, I'm trying to think that some photos that look at arrays of lights in the sky and some occasional things that look like triangles and stuff, but you would think if it were a space plane, I mean, something adapted for flying into space or up at the upper regions of the atmosphere, it wouldn't be traveling around down near within, let's say, a mile of the Earth's surface, where most UFO photos come from altitudes that are people looking up into the sky and seeing something that's less than a mile up, I would guess.
I
guess the answer to your question is no.
The reason I asked that question is there are these rings of smoke that have been found on the Google Earth map. I don't know if you're familiar with this. And they seem to indicate a pulse jet engine plane going in excess of 8,000 miles an hour. Have you heard about that?
Now, rings of smoke I had not heard about on Google. I have seen round knob-like things that several years ago somebody claimed, you know, where this is. They found one of them, and the world went around, the information went around the internet, and everybody checked up on it, and sure enough, there was this round, grayish-looking circular thing. It looked like it was up above the ground. And then as I searched in other areas, I found more and more of them, and it looked to me like they could be software pegs, as it were, where you patch together the pictures from different sources to create a large mosaic. And there have been some other things like that, if I recall, but I haven't heard anything about smoke rings.
Yeah, what I'm referring to, it looks like every once in a while there's a puff out of a jet plane, and the trail goes all the way from the United States, from it looks like California, into the middle of Europe.
Hmm. I'm not familiar with that.
What was your most interesting sighting or report?
Well, of course, I had quite a few. They're interesting and for various reasons. Jumbo Jet 1986. Let's see what I'm trying to think of. The Japan Airlines case in November of 1986. That involves air crew flying over Alaska and seeing objects suddenly appear in front of their aircraft and travel along in front of them for a period of a dozen minutes or so, and then zip off to the left side, apparently, and then the captain saw what he called the silhouette of a gigantic spacecraft behind him. That was interesting from the point of view of being a multiple witness sighting of something that was occurring on a big jetliner. And the FAA, the Federal Aeronautics Administration, actually investigated that case because there was radar involved. 20 years later to the day, was the O'Hare Airport thing in 2006, which was in November 2006, and made a big splash in the press on January 1st, I think it was, of 2007, when Hilkovich wrote an article that appeared in the Chicago Times, was it?
Yes.
Chicago Tribune, whatever.
Yeah, it was in Chicago, I know that. Yeah.
Or the Chicago paper, whichever one. And talked about this thing that was seen over the airport, and it suddenly went upwards through a cloud and punched its way through the cloud, leaving a hole. That was pretty interesting. I guess the most complex series of events that I've been involved in had to do with Gulf Breeze. The Gulf Breeze sighting starting in 1987 and going up into the 1990s. And perhaps the most scientifically oriented, in the sense that they have data available, were the New Zealand sightings of December 1978. The New Zealand sightings are unique because you have multiple witnesses on board an aircraft. Now, that's not so totally unique. And you have conversations between the plane and the Wellington Air Traffic Control Center. That's not so unique to have an air traffic control center tape. But there was a news crew on board the airplane at the time making their own tape recordings of what they saw and taking color movie film. And so you had some incidents and coincidences that would correspond to radar visual film sighting. In the UFO business, we often like to feature radar visual sighting where there's something that's detected on radar, at the same time somebody's seeing a light in the direction that the radar is pointing when it sees a target. And here we have a situation where somebody was filming what was being seen at the same time there was radar and tape recordings and so on. So, you know, like I said, they're all interesting for various reasons. And it'd be hard to say which is the most interesting.
How do you rate the Channel Island sighting?
You're talking about Bowker?
Yes.
What's his name? And that was analyzed quite carefully, I guess, a report published by NARCAP. That's where he claimed to have seen, Bowyer, where he claimed to have seen a huge orange, was it?
I think so. I think he said it was a mile in diameter at first.
An orange-colored light or something? I forget exactly.
Well, he said that he actually saw a saucer-shaped craft. And I think that there was a second plane involved, and the pilot...
Well, there was another airplane coming from another direction,
right.
I believe.
Yes, and the pilot tried it.
And there seemed to be a coincidence in the sense that they were both seeing the same thing at the same time.
Right.
And of course he had to carry on with his flight plan, so he landed. And I believe there were a couple of passengers that saw it also.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting. You know, multiple witnesses from the air, and a pilot is considered to be a reasonably good witness, especially in a situation where it's daytime.
Have you noticed any UFOs being attracted to anything other than nuclear power plants and military bases?
Well, there has in the past been an association with water. Of course, we have the USO type of report of submerged things, and the type of report where an object is seen going into the water and sometimes coming out. One of the first sightings that I investigated when I joined NICAP, National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena, the first version. There is now a new version of NICAP that appears on the internet, but the original NICAP was a organization long before the internet, and they had a collection of a big file cabinet full of sightings, and one of the sightings that I pulled out and investigated was a report made in 1957 or 58 of an event that occurred in 1945, I think it was, in Alaska, on a troop transport type of ship, a landing craft. A dozen guys there up near the, northwestern Alaska. What's the archipelago up there? I can't think of the name.
Not sure.
Anyway, they were off the coast a ways, and his report was that suddenly there was a big fluttering in the ocean or whatever. Water spraying around, all of a sudden something popped up out of the water, sort of hovered and vibrated and then took off at high speed. And of course all the guys are flabbergasted and immediately assume, well, this has to be some new Japanese weapon. And they were all debriefed, according to the guy who wrote the letter, they were all debriefed, and the information went back to Washington, and nobody knows where it went after that. Because it was a landing craft, it didn't have a log, and so we can't really track back on a particular date, but this guy's report was that all a dozen guys saw something come up out of the water and take off. And had that occurred a couple of years later, it would have been considered a flying saucer sighting of a strange type. So anyway, but you asked, you know, where things concentrated. Certainly during the early days, 40s and 50s, there seemed to be a lot of sightings around secure areas that were related to atomic bombs, like the Kirtland Air Force Base and Sandia Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Los Alamos area in New Mexico, Fort Hood in Texas. That's, of course, been in the news recently, but 60 years ago, that was they were seeing strange lights around the Killeen Base atomic weapons storage area on Fort Hood. And Oak Ridge, Tennessee had a bunch of sightings. Even the FBI got involved with those. Matter of fact, the FBI learned information about the sightings at Killeen Base and Fort Hood and Oak Ridge back in the late 40s and early 50s. Information in the FBI file about that stuff, because the FBI was justly concerned about espionage going on, and they wanted to know what these things in the sky were. Finally, the things in the sky sort of went away, and so did the problem, and nobody paid any attention to it after that, but it's a historical record that is still there. That is, the records are still there about what they reported. So I guess the answer to your question is, if there's anything other than nuclear, it's got something to do with water.
There's been a lot of talk about invisibility in UFOs, and they seem to become visible during some of the eclipses, as witnessed in Mexico a few years ago. Have you ever seen anything that would indicate to you that invisibility is a characteristic of some UFOs?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by invisibility. I suppose true invisibility would be Of course, we're talking about eyeball type, or taking a picture with a camera, which sort of simulates what your eyeball does. Optical invisibility, the object is standing there, or sitting there, or hovering there, or whatever, right in front of you, and you can't see it. What you can see is everything behind it, as if you're looking right through it, but you can't see the thing itself. That would be what I'd call true invisibility. There's another type of invisibility where it does something that renders your eye unable to see it. I wrote a paper, which is at my website, called Acceleration, which argued that if some objects, for example, were hovering in plain sight and you could see it, and all of a sudden it accelerated at an extremely high speed, or a large amount of acceleration, it could zip off to one side so fast that you would think that it, quote, disappeared, unquote, and was invisible. In other words, it was there 1 minute, the next minute it's, quote, invisible, unquote. The reason being, you couldn't see it move. Or maybe you saw it jiggle a little bit and it was gone so fast. And this has to do with the fact that your eye is only capable of seeing things that move in daytime, things that move at rates slower than a certain amount. If there's a phrase, a twinkling of the eye, something happening in the twinkling of an eye. Well, the twinkling of an eye happens to be around a 25th to a 30th of a second. And if an object could travel more than its own size in a 30th of a second, it might you might lose track of it and think it was invisible. So there's that first and second type of invisibility. Now, the first type of invisibility is hard to say, because if it's invisible, you may have no evidence that it's there. I did investigate a case in Florida, Gulf Breeze area, in 1994, I forget the year, saw my website. I wrote a paper entitled "The UFO with a Magnetic Personality." What we found was a case where there was a strong magnetic field in an area where there had been a UFO sighting. One night, this lady driving home saw, over her house, she saw appear over the back, from behind the house, a standard Model A type of disc that went upwards and then zipped off. So she had a flying disc sighting. She told her husband the next morning. Her husband, who just happened to have a very sensitive magnetometer device, he used the magnetometer for detecting well heads. He was into oil prospecting and stuff. And this magnetometer gadget is very sensitive to the magnetic field of the Earth, the magnetic field of magnets, and so on. He took this magnetic field device and walked out behind his house, thinking that, well, maybe this thing had come down and hovered behind his house, and maybe he'd see some effect on his magnetometer. Sure enough, he did. It was recorded on tape by MUFON, and I analyzed it. It turned out to be a huge magnetic field in an area where there shouldn't have been any at all, other than the Earth's normal field. As a matter of fact, I was told by some guys in the Navy lab that the size of the field that was detected was equivalent to the distortion of the Earth's field by a destroyer-sized vessel. We're talking a ship that's 50, 60, 70 feet wide and 150, 200 feet long. Well, now, they could move this magnetometer device, field gradient magnetometer it's called. They could move it around and find out where the magnetic field was strongest and where it was weakest. As they walked away from the general area, the magnetometer had no effect at all. Moving around, if you got close to some certain areas, in particular the top of a single tree, the magnetometer went crazy. And there was nothing there. There was absolutely no reason to have a magnetic field. There was nothing there but wood, sand, ordinary biological specimens, people, in this area of Florida. And nevertheless, they detected a huge magnetic field the day after this sighting. 2 days later, they went back and there wasn't any magnetic field. Whatever had been magnetic 2 days earlier had gone. Well, now you can't magnetize trees. You can't magnetize the dirt. So you have to ask yourself, what was creating that huge magnetic field? And they couldn't see a thing anywhere in the sky. Could this be a case of true invisibility of a craft? I don't know. Maybe the Klingons had their cloaking device on.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't talk about this much, but I saw something. Not a UFO sighting, but I was in my yard one time with my family, and I was watching the planes go by, and I heard rotors. And it sounded like they were over my head, and there was nothing there. So I took my binoculars, which have a red coating on the lens.
Mm-hmm.
I looked straight up, and I could see a helicopter with a platform underneath it. And I said to myself, how can this be? It was completely unmarked. I took down the glasses. I looked up again. I could see nothing. And I took the glasses and looked at it, and I saw it again.
This is daytime?
This is in the middle of the daytime, sitting in my yard about 2 in the afternoon. Yeah.
Hmm.
Now, this was not a UFO sighting, you know what I mean?
Right.
This was something else. But there was...
Something.
It seemed to me there was some sort of test going on, and that test involved invisibility, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was thinking of
another case I remember talking to, three-witness case in Gulf Breeze, Florida, about the time of all the sightings of Ed Walters and so on. Having Ray Pollock and his wife and his daughter and son-in-law standing on a pier at Gulf Breeze, Florida. And they were looking around to see if they could see. This is at a time when UFO sightings were quite common in that area, around 1991, 92. And he told me it was his daughter or son-in-law that first saw this thing behind them. It had just suddenly appeared out of thin air, so to speak. And while it was there, they could clearly see it silhouetted against, this is daytime sighting, they could clearly see it, the outline of it silhouetted against trees in the background and so on. It was a surreal, solid object sitting there doing nothing about a couple hundred feet from where they were. And he said all of a sudden it disappeared. And when he said disappeared, he said it didn't seem to move, it just was gone. Now, did it become invisible? People speculate on all sorts of stuff, like, well, went into another dimension. It zipped away at such a high speed that you couldn't see it. I don't know what. Some phenomena going on that we don't understand.
The thing I saw was always there because you could hear the rotors, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't see the object, you could hear the
noise. Well, it sounded like a strange condition of lighting of the sun. I don't know where the sun was during your sighting, but...
Well, this was very...
Too much glare in the air or something like that, then you were able to cut through the glare with the red glasses.
I got to say this, it was pretty low. You know what I mean? It was no more than 1,000 feet above me. Do you think that if extraterrestrials exist, that they may have walked on Earth and they could be among us now?
Well, yeah. It's probably not a controversial thing to say that if UFOs or UFO knots, extraterrestrials, whatever they are real and have been coming here ever since 1947 when we had the first sightings that we clearly classified as potentially ET or other non-human intelligence. That's a more general term I like to use, NHI. Non-human intelligence, that doesn't require that they be from another planet or another dimension or another time or whatever, just that they're not us. And if they've been here since 1947, they could have been here since 1847 or the year 47 or minus 1947. they could have been here a long time. I suppose there could be creatures walking among us now. And I suppose you've talked to Dave Jacobs at some time or other and his theory of hybrids. Essentially becoming adapted to living with us and essentially eventually taking over somehow. I don't know exactly what he predicts is going to happen, but he's not too happy about it. At any rate, the answer to your question is I wouldn't be surprised.
Great Britain has released quite a few of the UFO reports. Have you had a chance to look at any of them? And if so, is there anything that's caught your eye?
I have not... I haven't really had time to go through. I read part of the Condyne report that came out a few years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Which was a formerly secret or top secret report that even Nick Pope, he knew that there was something going on, but even he wasn't familiar with that report until it was finally admitted that, yes, we had done an official study on flying saucer sightings, and they released it. I think that was 4 or 5 years ago. I forget exactly. I did read through that, and that was a quite interesting, basically concluded that there was really something going on, but it might be more related to plasmas and stuff than ETs. But they used as data a number of the cases that ufologists use as evidence for ETs.
Nick Pope told me that, well, he didn't tell me, he mentioned in an interview that if certain types of cases came up, they actually made sure there was no paper trail left on them, so there was nothing to be released by the British government. Did you know that?
No, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised.
sort of defeats the whole thing, doesn't it?
The ultimate sweeping under the rug.
Yeah, I mean, if they're going to release everything, but then they're going to be picky about what they save, I mean, what good is it, you know?
If the really good stuff didn't have any records to begin with.
That's what I mean by saying that, you know. Why do you think that the U.S. is not releasing their UFO reports, as many other countries have done?
Well, the U.S. actually took the lead in releasing stuff. Starting way back in the 60s, they released in this organization I mentioned earlier, an ICAP, reports that were done by the Project Blue Book staff in the 1950s.
Hmm?
And then in the 1970s, in the 75, 76 time frame, the government made available the complete file of Project Blue Book, plus the files of the Air Force Office of Special Investigation. These were all files that were classified up to secret level, but there weren't any top secret files. In the latter 1980s, there was a monster file of documents of all sorts that had been generated by the Air Force Intelligence documents, Record Group 340 or whatever it was called, hundreds of feet of boxes of documents, which were searched and turned up documents related to UFOs, amongst other things. The Coast Guard released some stuff, and the NSA, the CIA was forced under the Freedom of Information Act to cough up 900 and some pages in December 1978. The FBI released 1,600 pages in 1977. The State Department has released some documents. A few other organizations here and there. National Security Agency was beaten on until they released stuff. So the U.S. has really taken the lead. It's just that the news media and a lot of ufologists, the young guys in ufology, don't know about what happened 40 years ago, and the media doesn't have that sort of a recollection. So what they hear is that, France is releasing stuff, and Brazil is releasing stuff, and the English, the British are releasing stuff, and Chile and so on, and it's all new information, and so then they say, well, why isn't the United States releasing stuff? And the answer, I suppose, is, you know, the United States released everything that was going to release over the last 30 years, starting back in the 60s. Whatever the United States has that hasn't been released, the stuff they're not going to release, and probably won't, until it's absolutely proven that UFOs are real and everybody knows it, at which point the government will say, oh yeah, well, we knew it all along, but we just didn't tell you.
Yeah. It seems that odd photos are slipping through from NASA and other sources. Lately, some have been spotted on Google Earth and Google Moon.
What photos?
Odd photos. By odd, I mean photos that could show evidence of past civilizations and UFOs.
ART? A-R-T?
No, O-D-D.
What is it?
ODD.
Odd.
Yeah.
Odd photos. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Unusual.
Unusual photos. that could show evidence of past civilizations and UFOs. Do you think that maybe this could be on purpose to alert us to the existence of UFOs?
You're talking about, what you said these were NASA photos?
NASA and other sources, yes. What I'm really trying to, maybe I should rephrase this. What I'm saying is that controversial photos have been appearing in the last few years. Some of them seem to indicate, like some of the ones on the moon, that there may have been structures left on the moon and UFOs. Do you think this could be on purpose to sort of like condition us to the fact that UFOs exist?
Well, I think that sort of conditioning is taking place regardless of odd photos from Mars and the moon and whatever it is you're talking about. I'm not sure what type of odd photos. I've seen claims that the certain areas of Mars prove that there were cities there because you've got a matrix-type array of lines that make it look like there were streets and buildings and so on. Something which I'm sure is an artifact of the way the pictures were taken and pasted together. There are claims of structures on the moon. I have yet to be convinced that there are structures on the moon. You know, big, what was it, some big high glass tower that was broken or something.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
A lot of this is pulled out of imagery where you blow it up to the point that you're looking at the, you have to be careful of the noise level of what you're looking at, and bright and dark areas, when they're blown up sufficiently, can take on what appear to be structures of their own. I call this a sort of a Rorschach test for the investigator, where you're told to look at a series of ink blots and make a picture out of it. Try to decide what it looks like, and finally you decide, well, it looks like a man, or it looks like a car, or it looks like a horse. And the difference is people do this sort of thing with photos of the moon, photos of Mars, and if they blow it up to a certain extent, they find some image that looks like a car, looks like a boat, looks like a building, looks like a rocket, looks like whatever. Then they publish that they have evidence of a book or a boat or a building or a city or whatever on Mars, whereas in fact all they've got really is a noise level effect that made it look like something or other, but it really wasn't. So I've been confronted with pictures like that quite often, including I remember one guy who was always sending me pictures of, quote, Bigfoot, unquote, hidden in the bushes. He would take a picture of a just an ordinary scene that has trees and bushes and stuff like that in it. And then he would blow it up to the point where he was looking at the shadow, light and dark areas in the shadows between the leaves and stuff. And they'd say, oh, look, you see, here's the eyeball, and here's a nose, and here's a mouth. And it wasn't very convincing.
Right. Over the years, there's been many reports of crashed UFOs. What is your personal opinion as to whether we have found any alien bodies or even live beings on crashed UFOs?
Well, first of all, let me say I don't believe the Mogul Balloon Theory. And I guess that when you say you don't believe the Mogul Balloon Theory nowadays, that says a lot.
Well, I don't believe it either.
it says that there really is some hardware somewhere that somebody's got. And the frustrating thing about Roswell is, in principle, you know there is a definitive answer to all the questions. But in practice, you can't get to the materials, stuff that would tell you what that answer is. One reason why I sort of stayed away from Roswell investigation, I've read about it, you know, I've paid attention to what's going on, but I have not been in the forefront of Roswell research because I know that in principle, until the government coughs the stuff up, there's always that last one big giant leap for mankind. When you jump over the barrier and land right next to the Roswell crash object and bodies and whatever. That's one of the things that Uncle's, when everybody believes that UFOs are real, it's basically been proven by civilians the government will say, yeah, well, we knew it all along. And at that point, they may well say, well, oh, yeah, well, here's the bodies, and we were in communication with these guys, and we've got all these things you hear about, agreements between us and them as to whether we should leave them alone or let them do whatever they want to do or whatever. All that may be true, but the government won't admit it until the very end. So as far as crashes are concerned, I don't know how many there are. I know that Ryan Woods has compiled a book. Other people have put together a book, Kevin Randall's, on all the crashes that supposedly have occurred. I'm not convinced that there are that many crashes, but all you need is one.
Well, the story I heard was that once there was one or two crashes, we determined that some of our radar somehow was interfering with the propulsion system on UFOs, and we started aiming some of our high-powered radar at them. I don't know if you've heard that or not.
I've heard about the suggestion that high-powered radar may have affected their navigation equipment or whatever. I don't recall hearing that we may have intentionally tried to shoot them down, as it were, using radar or electromagnetic pulses.
The Disclosure Project has many different witnesses from all walks of life testifying that UFOs are extraterrestrial and that the government is hiding the fact. Some of these witnesses are former government employees. Do you think that most of these witnesses are credible?
Well, I know that some of them are. I'm not familiar with all their stories, first of all. And there are a number of them which I think are not quite credible. But what's important, of course, the ones that are credible. Now, you said the Disclosure Project.
Right.
That's the term used by Greer and the boys.
That's right.
The Coalition for Freedom of Information by Leslie Keene and press conference that they held.
Yes.
In November of 2007, was it? At the National Press Club, where they had pilots and military people and John Callahan from the FAA Colonel Halt was there from the Rendlesham case, along with Pendleton, or what's his name. Now, all those guys were, you might say, hand-picked to be highly credible. The guy from Chile who actually chased a flying saucer. Parviz Jafari, the pilot of one of the 1976 Iran jet case.
I think he had a Phantom jet.
Right, an F-4 Phantom jet chasing, and then having the communications and avionics suddenly go out when he got to about 25 miles away.
Right.
This was a high-powered group of people, much better selected, I would say, than Greer's 400. And the surprising, well, maybe not too surprising, disappointing thing was that went over almost like a lead balloon as far as the Washington press was concerned. A lot of people there, but, it didn't produce anything, so far as I could tell. It cost a lot to bring those people together. James Fox, I guess, paid for most of that. But anyway, that type of a disclosure, that type of a attempt at forcing the government, if you keep that up, if there were funding to keep that sort of thing up, I think you would turn the situation around. And Boyer was there, and I met him, the guy at the Channel Islands thing. He was at that press conference.
Right.
Well, that was what? Yeah, that was November 2007, wasn't it?
I'm not sure of the date. I know it was only a few years ago, but I don't know the exact year,
You can look it up on the Internet. You can see each person had a short paragraph type of testimony that he read. And then he was available for interviews by interested people afterwards. So each one of them had a long story to tell. They had to be able to, during the press conference itself, they had to be able to shorten it down. And the press conference statements are all available on the Internet.
Right. Are videos easier or harder for you to analyze than still photos?
Well, of course, videos can take a lot more time because there's a lot more images. Like, for example, in the New Zealand case, it wasn't a video, it was a color movie film. Literally thousands of frames of images that I looked at before I could arrive at some conclusions as to what was going on. If you got a few photos, you don't have as much data to work with. That can be both bad and good. It certainly means you don't have as many things to do. But on the other hand, I spent a lot of time on the McMinnville photograph case. McMinnville, Oregon, May 1950. Farmer Paul Trenton's wife. This stuff is on my website. The largest report on the McMinnville case. And these two photos, I don't know if you're familiar with them or not.
I am, yes.
Yes, well, they're very clear. It's either the real thing or a hoax. There's no halfway point. And so that's in the government and contractor research sector. That type of research is known as high risk, high payoff. like I said, there's no halfway point. There's no misidentification. If this thing flew by, like they said, and with the shape that it's got, it wasn't ours. So that was only two pictures. And what I do, I spent several years part-time work analyzing the photos. And, of course, I also went into everything else, the history of the sighting and the character of the Trents, you know, would they be likely to try to pull off a hoax of any form at all, to say nothing of a UFO hoax? And, the answer I arrived at was no. But you asked me which is more difficult, photos or video. I spent more time on the McMinnville photos than I spent on many videos.
Uh-huh.
Lots of videos that I look at. When I'm told how they were taken, you know, they turn out to be something like, well, this guy videotaped Venus for half an hour. Or I remember one man who sent me videos of lighted objects going over his house, and he said they would always go over my house, and then they would disappear on the other on a mountain that was across a small valley. They would disappear over there, and he felt they landed on the other side of the hill. And he kept sending, he made a video that had a number of his, quote, sightings, unquote. Well, so when I played this thing back and turned the volume up, I could see the lights up there, all right. I could also hear the noise of a jet engine. And sure enough, it went over towards where that mountain was and then disappeared, but, you know, it was basically just continuing its path.
Right, right.
And he wanted me to come up to New Hampshire and verify that these were real UFOs, and then we would go public with it and make lots of money.
Yeah. Do you think that with the technology today, that a movie studio or somebody with, like, really sophisticated equipment could, say, create a photo that could fool even the experts?
Well, yeah, you've got to create not just the photo, but the story behind it.
Right.
There's no doubt that somebody who is intent on doing a sophisticated hoax could do it. Now, if you do it totally by CGI, computer-generated imagery, there are super experts who could at least comment on how good the hoax has to be in order to do that. The more sophisticated you get, the more you have to have knowledge. So the investigator would say, first of all, okay, Joe Smith brings to me a photograph and says it's a UFO, and he says he saw it in his backyard, and it was hovering over the neighbor's house, and he ran and got his camera and came back outside, took one photograph, and then the thing zipped away. So it's a pretty simple, straightforward UFO sighting. And, oh, by the way, Joe happens to work for Spielberg Incorporated. Well, you know, it's be like the fox being in the hen house, I guess. If the guy has time, money, desire, and capability, and equipment, access to equipment. When we went down to the Gulf Breeze situation, one of the first things, I spent time looking at Ed Walter's photos. This is back in 1987. And when I got involved in February 1988, the first question was Ed Walters an inveterate hoaxer? And could he have created these things with his camera? And so we investigated the camera and found out, yep, you could do double exposures with a camera. Now, in further investigation, I found out some things about some of his pictures, how it could not be created by the simple double exposure method that was used by this camera. It could be done by a Hollywood-level technique as a masked double exposure, but not a simple double exposure like Ed could do with his camera. So basically, the capability of the witness in that case indicated that the photo was probably real. That's where the person could have the desire to do it, could have the money to do it, could even have the information to do it, but didn't have the equipment to do it. And of course, you never know. You know, somebody comes to you with a photograph, you don't really know a priori whether the person is hoaxing or telling the truth. And so you have to judge all these other things. And like I said, the guy brings me a photograph, and oh, by the way, he works for one of the major Hollywood studios that does computer-generated imagery, then I would be the first to say, well, I'm very skeptical about this picture. And on the Internet, you know, there have been over the last several years, 5 or 6 years, what appear to be intentional photo hoaxes. The Chad drone, you familiar with that?
No, I don't think I can. Oh, wait a second. Is that the circular thing with the pieces sticking, rods like sticking out of it over a high-tension wire?
Yeah.
Okay, then I
guess. Now, that case began with these pictures showing up in a guy in a story that we were visiting our friends, and all of a sudden this thing appeared, and we decided to take some pictures of it. One of the things that struck me was the guy says, my friend, he actually used a name, I don't know what the name was, Sam Smith, somewhere. Well, it was very brave and ran right up underneath it to take a picture, looking right straight up. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, right. If there's a real UFO up there, you're going to be likely to run underneath it to take a picture.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was kicked around for a number of months, actually a couple of years, and ultimately ended up that it was proven CGI.
Uh-huh.
Other people came along and made their own versions of it. That is demonstrating. Guys who did not believe that this thing was real said, hey, I'm a CGI guy. I can do it myself. And so I saw a number of what you might call fakes squared. If the original was a fake, these people were faking something to make it look like the original fake. So I guess that's a fake.
I guess so.
Anyway, it makes it difficult nowadays to say just from the pictures, you know, what's going on. You take a picture with a digital camera, you can easily suck it into your computer, grab it with a Photoshop or some sophisticated image processing software. Take a picture of a daylight scene and insert into it a CGI UFO, computer-generated imagery of a UFO. And if you're good enough at inserting it, it will be impossible, I suppose, to tell whether it was, you know, real or fake. You've got to get all the lighting right. You have to have the blending between the CGI pixels and the real scene pixels have to be just right. But if you can get all that stuff right, you know, nobody could argue against it. Then it would, the argument would be, we can't use the picture to prove it's a hoax. Same thing with the Trent case. You can't use the pictures to prove they're a hoax. So what you fall back on is the character of the people involved. In the Trent case, the McGregor Oregon 1950 pictures, there was no way that they were, so far as I could tell, the idea of hoaxing anything was completely out of their lifestyle.
Right.
Yeah, they could have hung a model on a string from some wires that run overhead. And they could have been lucky about the model obeyed certain photometric conditions that were tested by William Hartman in the Condon study. This is one of the few photographs actually studied by the Condon people in the 1960s. The bottom line is you can't use the photos to prove it's a hoax. The photos don't prove it's real either, because it could be a fake that's so good that you can't detect it, you see. That applies to modern CGI imagery, modern digital camera imagery, as well as to old-fashioned photos. The worst, the best a photo can do is act as an aid to the witness. The worst it can do is contain information that absolutely proves it's a hoax. For example, I've seen movies. I remember watching a movie one time where some guys in West Virginia claimed they had a UFO sighting near an airport. So you look at the movie and you're looking through one of these wire fences at an airport, you see an airplane land, and no sooner does the airplane disappear out of the picture, and all of a sudden comes, I hate to use the term, swinging into the picture, the UFO.
I've seen those.
Your old fishing rod UFO model, and you can see the string, and you can see the model, and it wobbles and all sorts of shit. And they're trying to pass this off. You know, for $10, I'll sell you my UFO movie.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't take the picture, but it's still, you know.
Right. In any case, bottom line is the film could have evidence that proves a hoax, but it's, you got to be really good. There has to be really something unique to be able to prove. Certainly with a certain photo, maybe a better chance with a video or movie to prove that it's real without having to look at the character and everything in the background of the witness. But if you're just presented with a photograph, especially nowadays, you better know the capabilities, the desires, the and so on of the witness before you try to make any positive statement about it.
All right. Are you up for three more questions?
Sure.
Ron Stewart, the well-known imaging scientist, is said to have invented a process known as APEP, or the Advanced Photographic Extraction Process. Supposedly, this can increase resolution by up to 10,000% by increasing the average dots per inch to 10,000 dots per inch, or DPI. Have you heard of this, and is it reliable?
I've seen stuff about that, which I don't believe. It talks about increasing the resolution. I don't know, if you got a digital picture to begin with, and you've got a certain number of images, a certain number of pixels, and each pixel has a constant level of brightness and color across it. Now, if you start taking that pixel apart, increasing the number of pixels, in other words, by making, let's say, each pixel suddenly divided into 10 parts, you're not going to learn anything that you knew or didn't know before. You're just taking a constant level of one pixel. You have to look very carefully at a photograph, a digital photograph, to see what I'm talking about. If you keep blowing up digital photographs more and more and more with your computer programs, until you see one, you can see each individual pixel as a big square. And that big square will have a constant level of intensity and or brightness and color across it. And things look blocky when you get that much magnification. So if you divide that pixel into a whole bunch of parts, you haven't learned anything you didn't already know. Well, anyway, the bottom line is I'm skeptical of... And I don't know if this is a well-known photo analyst in the first place, whatever the terminology was you used at the beginning when you introduced him.
Well, I said well-known, but I personally have no knowledge of him. But I've read about him, you know.
Sounds almost like a scam to me.
When you helped to reanalyze the famous Project Blue Book report, what was the conclusion you came to?
Well, now, wait a minute. The famous Project Blue Book report. There wasn't any overall report. I don't know what you mean.
Well, Project did... Maybe I'm wrong here, but I was under the impression that after Project Blue Book came out, that it was reanalyzed by you.
Well, Project Blue Book released a whole bunch of documents.
Right.
Sightings and analyses and so on 92 rolls of microfilm in 1975 or 76.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know if that's what you mean. There was the Condon report, which was an independent evaluation, supposedly an independent evaluation of Project Blue Book results. The Condon report was done in 1967 to 68, published in 69.
It might have been the Condon report. I'm not sure now.
I didn't do a report on the Condon report.
Oh, you did.
And to do a report on I didn't do any report on an overall report on Project Blue Book itself. I've put in my UFO FBI connection book, which unfortunately has gone out of print years ago. But it's still available for a buck or half a buck or 2 bits or 10 cents or a nickel.
Oh, no, I can't have it.
it's still available in secondhand versions of Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever. But that does talk about the history, early history of Project Blue Book and the Air Force investigation, but I have not tried to write a report on the whole of Project Blue Book.
Okay, I'm wrong on that. I apologize. Here's another one for you. Correct me if I'm wrong again. You declared in the 1997 Mexico City UFO sighting that it was a hoax.
Yes.
Could you describe the sighting for my audience and tell them why you thought this was a hoax?
You're talking about August 6, 1997?
Yes, I believe that's it, with the one that flew over the apartment building?
Right.
Yes.
And that really caused a big flap when that came down the pike. It turned up in the mailbox of Jaime Massan in Mexico, unannounced, as I recall. And he didn't know where it was taken, didn't know who had taken it. It had a letter along with it where the guy said, we saw this thing and videotaped it. And because I think the implication was he was not a native Mexican. He was working illegally in Mexico or something like that, so he didn't want to release his name. So it was an anonymous video. And I and another guy, Jeff Senio, both MUFON analysts, really spent a lot of time on this thing. I don't know, a few hundred hours maybe. I know he spent a lot, he may have spent more time than I did. Because this thing, the film starts off showing an object hovering, rotating, wobbling a bit at the left of a big apartment building. And then it moves towards the apartment building, but it's obviously on the other side of the apartment building if it's real, because it disappears behind the apartment building and then comes up above the apartment building roof and goes along roughly horizontally while rotating and wobbling a bit. I can't remember exactly how it disappeared. It sort of goes behind something that's a higher level of the apartment building, I think, and then is no longer seen. Now it's 30 seconds. I forget exactly how long the duration is. Plenty of time to have zillions of frames to analyze. We spent a lot of time analyzing, and I was thinking, this might be real. But then Jeff Senio was doing an analysis of the dynamics of the object compared to using the buildings as a reference point. And each frame, this was apparently a handheld camera. And so you have jiggling of the image and jiggling of the building images. And ideally you would have a stationary building. You would have no vibration at all. So Jeff Senio was writing a program, had written a program to effectively make the building stand still as you played this video. Make the building stand still, and then you could see the motion of the object relative to the building. And when he did that, he began to notice something strange. When a building moves in the image, as the hand is vibrating holding the camera, the motion of the building during the frame time, the time of the exposure, 1/130th of a second, 1/130th of a second time. If the building image moves, it smears the edge of the image. And he could look at the amount of edge smear of the building, and he could look at the amount of edge smear of the UFO image. And they didn't correlate. The UFO image edge seemed to be a lot more steady than the building image, implying that the UFO image was not real and out there. Then I managed to find two frames where the motion was fast and large enough that you could clearly see just in these two frames what I was talking about, which I call the fingerprints of a hoax. Namely that the building edges are smeared by camera motion and the UFO image isn't. When you think about it, if a UFO is out there in real space right next to a building and you're photographing it and you tilt the camera, so let's say suddenly upwards, when you play it back, the image will suddenly move downwards. As the image moves, if you go at it frame by frame, look at the edge of the building, you'll find the edge of the building, the horizontal edge of the building, is smeared by the sudden downward motion of the image. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can see that the edge of the building was smeared, but guess what? The edge of the UFO was not. Hmm. The only way I could think of that would explain that would be if this was a CGI. And, oh, by the way, when that thing came out in 1997, in the fall, summer 1997, I was contacted by a number of CGI guys who said, hey, I can do that. And sure enough, quite a few people came up with their own simulations of this video.
Well, you know, that reminds me of, I don't know if you know who the great Randy is.
Randy?
The magician.
Yes.
But he told me that he could duplicate anything that anybody did, you know. And I was thinking to myself at the time, how would you ever know if something was real? Because he could duplicate it by doing it in a way that it was a trick, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I think we've gotten to the point today where it's almost impossible, getting to be impossible to know if something is real anymore, unless there's been a lot of witnesses to the event. What do you think?
Yeah, and even having lots of witnesses can be a problem, too.
Yeah, I think so.
Because witnesses typically come up with different stories from their different points of view. It depends on how complex the event is. There is a video case from Greifswald, Germany, which I haven't seen for a number of years. I think it occurred back in the 80s or early 90s. But that was where some strange lights were up in the sky, and they were videotaped from locations that were, I think, hundreds of thousands of feet or maybe miles apart. I forget exactly. That's a what you might call sort of an ideal type of case to look at, where you've got witnesses unconnected to each other and videos that are time recording what's going on. If Randy can generate anything, well, what the hell, we may as well all go to bed and let him generate them tomorrow.
Well, he was talking more about, like, Uri Geller's tricks with the spoons and different things like that, you know, at the time.
Yeah, right.
He was saying that there was nothing paranormal about it. And he said, I could do any of that stuff, you know. And he said it wasn't fair because Uri Geller is still famous, and Randy, who's offering $1 million if he can't duplicate the event, is not famous anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know who J. Allen Hynek was?
Yes, I do. He later on, he became a supporter of UFOs. He was the Blue Book scientist. Yes.
In 1980, there was a UFO symposium at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. I was there, and to speak, Hynek was there, Phil Glass was there, Robert Schaefer was there. The audience had such luminaries as Stan Friedman and other people, and, of course, the general population. At lunchtime, we went down into the basement, and there were served at a table, a series of tables where people were sitting. I'm trying to think of what's his name, the guy who wrote the Robertson panel report. can't think of his name offhand. Maybe it'll come to me. But anyway, we'll just say his name is Guy for the moment.
Okay.
He was an old buddy of Hynek. No, I had known Hynek for years. He was head of the Rocket Society in the 50s. And he had worked for the CIA and wrote the so-called famous Robertson Panel Report, which you could look up if you don't know what it is. Anyway, Hynek's on my right, Guy is on my left, and I'm sitting there, and Hynek starts to talk about spoon bending.
Really?
Hynek was a rather straight-laced guy, but he was into some far-out stuff, and he, in fact, I think near the end he was assigning UFOs to some sort of paranormal thing more than ETs. But in any event, he was explaining to Guy, talking across me as it were, explaining to Guy how he had met Geller and discussed the situation of mental capabilities and so on with Geller. And Hynek says, Geller took one of my keys, I think it was one of Hynek's keys, and held it in his hand and claimed that it started to get soft, and then he put the key and it started to bend. And at this point, Geller put the key on a table and took his hands away from it. And Hynek says, he was looking at this key and there was no hands anywhere near it. It continued to bend. And Hynek is being very forceful in this description. And Guy is having nothing to do with that. He wouldn't believe it, you know. And so that was Fred, what's his last name? Fred something rather was the name of the guy I'm trying to think of. Anyway, Fred would have none of it. But Hynek was saying there, it continued to bend and there was nobody touching it. Now, I'd like to see you know, that sort of thing happened with Randy. I suppose he could come up with some kind of a very trick key that is capable of bending itself. But this was a key supposedly that Hynek had in his pocket and pulled forth in order to have Geller bend it.
Well, Randy is a very resourceful man, let me tell you. He only made, as far as I know, he made one big major mistake in his life. He used to go into safes and claim that he could get out of any safe. I don't know if you know this.
No.
And he, to promote himself, he went into one of the local newspapers. They had this model of a safe he knew about. And he said to them, I could go in your safe and get out. And they said, if you can do that, we'll write a big story about you, you know. So he gets into the safe, he locks the door, and then he goes, oh, my God, what happened was the safe had been remodeled. And he couldn't figure out how to open it, you know. And
mm-hmm.
He almost died. They had to get a guy to open the safe and everything. And the guy, there was nobody there at the time. He had to come from his house. And the safe was very hard to open. And Randy almost expired from lack of oxygen, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that was his big mistake.
Well, he got himself into trouble. As I recall, he was sued himself by Eldon Byrd.
Oh, he's been sued a couple of times, I believe.
Yeah.
But anyway, is there anything else that you can think of that might be interesting since our last interview?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about in our last interview, so...
Yeah, no, it was about a year ago, I think, we had an interview, you and
mm-hmm.
I. But,
well, of course, there's all sorts of stuff coming along continuously.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know if we talked about the Serpo stuff back then. I haven't been reading it diligently, but you're familiar with Serpo?
No, I'm not.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is supposedly a story of a exchange program.
Oh, that's Serpo. You're talking about Project Serpo.
Started in the 70s.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
And supposedly a dozen of our guys
right.
went to Planet Serpo, and a dozen of their guys came here.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I mentioned that in my last interview to Dennis Balthasar. We were talking about that.
What did Dennis have to say about it?
Well, he doesn't put much faith in it.
Yeah, well, neither do I. when the first or second or third communications from the whoever it is, the anonymous person who's leaking all this information supposedly, described how Planet Serpo goes around one of the Zeta Reticuli stars.
Right, right.
Picking up on the Betty and Barney Hill case, I guess.
Right, and it's so,
He provided certain astronomical data on Planet Serpo, the rotation time, the time of a year, the rotation of the planet, the, how long a year was in terms of our years and so on. And I don't know who made up the numbers, but they didn't fit the so-called laws of Kepler, mm-hmm. which describe how planet the time period of planets. If you get a certain distance from the sun, then you're going to have a certain period of time to go around the sun. When you're up close, the period is short. When you're a long distance away, the period is longer, and there's a mathematical formula uh-huh. worked out first by Kepler that tells you how long a year is, a year being one rotation. How long is a year as a function of how far away you are. And of course, in the Serpo situation, you have two stars, so you have a more complex orbit, maybe. But the bottom line was that the supposedly astronomical data that they came up with didn't make any sense. Either it was completely fabricated, or else astronomical laws don't hold for other star systems. You know, which nobody's going to buy that.
Well, at least the project didn't make much sense to start with.
Well, all the other stuff, I haven't really kept up with it. But I understand, you know, that there's supposedly a lot of other stuff about how these people, our guys went there for 10 years or something like that. I forget how many years it was. And not all of them came back. One of them died there. A couple of them decided to stay and so on.
Yeah, there's so much of that stuff, like with the Dulf invasion, where we supposedly invaded the underground base, and
that's another thing that's been recent. Dulce investigations. Now, you know, UFO hunters did that.
Uh-huh.
And they had to do it, I guess, last winter, because there was snow around. Have you seen the show?
Yes, I have. And I saw that particular one, too.
Right. And they're not the first people, of course, to investigate the Dulce stuff. That goes way back into the 80s.
Right.
Goes back to Benowitz. Dr. Benowitz and his, and the, what was the name of the abductee that he was working with, who claimed that there was an underground base at Dulce where humans and aliens worked.
That's right.
And the aliens were, there were big vats of human parts. I don't remember all the stuff that went along with the story.
They said that the aliens were supposed to make a list of all the humans they abducted, and they weren't supposed to hurt them or anything. And they were taking way more than they were supposed to. They weren't making any lists, so they were hurting humans. And then supposedly we invaded the base, and most of our people got killed.
Yeah, right. Well, way back in the middle 80s, soon after that came out, Bill Moore and other people, James McCampbell, who was a scientist interested in UFOs, Jim McCampbell and some other people. McCampbell had me analyze a photo that Benowitz had taken. Benowitz had taken a photo from the air looking downwards at the top of the mesa, and there were stones and rocks and stuff. Benowitz had identified in his picture, I forget, things like a laser ray weapon or something like that, and crashed saucers and military vehicles and all sorts of stuff supposedly on the top of this mesa. Of course, this was like the Rorschach test I was talking to you earlier about.
Right.
Looking at blow-up pictures of the moon or Mars or trees and grass looking for Bigfoot. You blow it up far enough and you can see all sorts of stuff. Well, that's what Benowitz did. But anyway, people went down there and looked. Back in the middle 80s, nobody could find any entrances or whatever to underground bases, no evidence of underground bases. And the UFO hunters just last year, I guess it was, did the same thing, and they didn't find anything either, so.
Yeah, it was last year.
Yeah. Nobody's found anything, is what I'm honest with. And then a lot of people have looked.
Right. Well, it's an interesting story, anyway.
An interesting story, but probably should be done away with.
Probably. Well, listen, I really want to thank you. This was a very interesting interview, and I'm very sure I enjoyed myself.
Well, thank you for inviting me.